This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and it is all presented by our friends at Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you joining me for the next hour on Sirius 162 XM 207, streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net and podcast on podcast platforms each and every week. So wherever you get your podcast, type in Horse Racing Radio Network, and you can listen to not just this show, but all of the shows we bring your way each and every week. Well, today I get the opportunity to visit with not one, but two trainers, each at different points in their respective careers, and each with plenty to talk about on this Wednesday edition of the program. In the first half of the show, I welcome trainer Safi Joseph Jr., who has found a way to do what so many before him could not, and that's dethrone Hall of Fame trainer Todd Pletcher as leading trainer of Gulfstream's championship meet. And he's done it each of the past two seasons. We're going to discuss the keys to pulling off the hat trick at this year's championship meet, which begins on Friday. In the second half of today's show, you'll hear from trainer Whit Beckman, who first joined me on Trainer Talk in October of 2021. At that point, Whit, a longtime Todd Pletcher assistant, had yet to saddle his first winner in the U.S. Today, he joins me as a graded stakes winning trainer after saddling Honor Marie to an upset victory in Saturday's Kentucky Jockey Club Stakes at Churchill Downs in his home city of Louisville, Kentucky. So a couple of outstanding guests to get to here for you. I think you're really going to enjoy the show. Let's kick it off with my good friend, Safi Joseph Jr. Saf, happy to have you aboard, my friend.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
All right, what is the key? How do you do it? How do you knock off Todd Pletcher and everybody else again this year?
Well, you need to have the horses, and the owners provide that. They need to stay solid and healthy, and then obviously the staff. The staff to do all the work. They take great care of them, and that's what we needed.
I remember a couple of years ago, you and I talking, and at that point, you hadn't yet won that first championship meet title, but you were really on a roll coming in off of the summer meet at Gulfstream. And you told me that you felt very confident in your abilities to take home the leading trainer title at the championship meet that year. And it wasn't just talk from you. You really believed you had the horses and the numbers to get it done. Same thing this year?
Yeah, I think we're in a good position this year again. We're up there on numbers, and we got quality also, and that's what you kind of need. You need numbers, and you need quality at a championship because there's a lot of more higher-end races. So I feel like we're in a very good spot. Things have to go right. The horses have to stay healthy, and obviously in the winter, the temperature changes and sort of frequent, so you get a lot more viruses during the winter time, so we need to kind of control that as much as we can. And I think if all that happens, we're in a very good position to repeat again for the third time.
Can you believe that this is actually happening? I mean, you and I talked several years ago. We sat in your barn in your office at the barn at Gulfstream Park, and we talked about you being a native of Barbados and coming here and working so hard and loving the horses and all of these different things. But at that point, you hadn't yet gotten to that level. And then all of a sudden, man, these past several years, it's just been an incredible ride for you. Do you ever pinch yourself and say, hey, is this actually real?
Every single day. Up to like maybe like half an hour ago, I was telling my dad, you ever believe that we'd be in this position? And it's literally a dream. As I said, we started with two horses. We got like 5, 7 in the first year. And then for the next couple of years, 4 or 5 years, we were probably at 15. So we didn't have enough clients. Really had our horses, basically. And it's propelled to the stage that it's at now. And just grateful for all the opportunities. Grateful and blessed. And thank God for giving us everything he's given us and blessed us with.
Was it maybe even a little bit disheartening early on when you didn't have many horses and you weren't competing at the level you wanted to compete at? You knew you could get there, but you just weren't there yet. Was it a little tough and a little disheartening in those years?
Yeah, it definitely you question are you good enough? That thought definitely runs through your head. I mean, you believe you are, but you do question it, like if the opportunities will come. And you understand the situation. Why would somebody want to give you a horse? You come from Barbados, they don't know you, and there's a lot of trainers with better resumes that are proven already. So the reality was there that, I mean, people will just walk by you and don't even consider you for a horse. But we kept just trying to knock away, and we got some chances, and that's what led referrals from each owner led us to get more owners. And after that, once you get the opportunities, it's much easier than not having an opportunity.
Can you point to a singular moment or two that you would consider to be, let's call it your big break, the moment when things started to turn and you were able to start ascending?
I think Frank Calabrese came aboard. He came aboard and he asked if at that point we were going through a phase where we didn't have many horses from outside owners, and we actually had took some horses on deals. That's probably the biggest mistake I ever made in my career, because it doesn't really pay for a trainer, but you're just trying to prove yourself to get some numbers up there. And when he came along, it was like he put stability into the barn, because he brought probably like 15 horses at that time to us. And then he said he could go ahead and claim horses, and basically he gave you a free hand to show your talent. And that would be like for a trainer, that would be your, like a basketball player getting a scouts to watch him. And I'm forever grateful to him. He definitely provided that stability in our barn, and from there it led to other owners. I mean, Mike Ryan, E5 came along, and just to have those, they gave us one horse here and there, but just to have that kind of association with people successful, it made other people take notice. And at that point, we were probably like 25, 30 horses. So it started to go forward from there. And I mean, that's definitely the changing point. I'll never forget the call. Frank called me. I was in Barbados. I just actually went on vacation with my family for a week, and I was at the races in Barbados, and he called me and he says, on Monday, go pick up the horses. And that was a call that feels like it was just yesterday.
There's a saying, Safi, that says success breeds success. And as you get the ball rolling with a guy like Frank Calabrese, it seemed to me from the outside looking in that all of a sudden there were other owners that picked up the phone and said, hey, Saf, what do you think of training my horse? Did it work like that?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, you train for Frank Calabrese, your percentage is going to go up. There's no two ways. If you can't win for him, you're never going to win. And everybody that's trained for him has won. As I said, he's a trainer's gift, basically. And he is tough on you. But and that was one thing going in. I knew that he would fire trainers so often. And when I first started, I said, if I could last 1 year with Frank, it would help get me. And we lasted to basically to his last horses. I mean, I still call him weekly. He's 94, 95 now. And because I'm forever thankful for him. I mean, like we just built a good relationship, and it did lead to other horses, more people coming. As your percentage grows, people take notice. Like, who is this person within? And I mean, stats are so important in today's day. I think they're kind of overrated in a way, but that's what most people want. They want percentage and stats.
You said that Frank is tough on you as a trainer. How is an owner tough on a trainer?
No, he wasn't. He had that reputation as being tough, that, you know, like people trained for him and he would switch trainers. So, but with us, I consider him fair. I mean, he's given me the chance to run horses and claim horses, and all he wants is winners. That's what he wants, is to produce winners. And he doesn't mind if a horse has to drop in and win. So I understand what his goals were, and I think that's what made us get along so good. I understood what he needed. He didn't want you to be a hero and try to improve every horse. He rather a horse, if you claim it for 20, he'd rather run for 16 and win than to raise it for 40 and run second. And his goal was winning, and my goal was winning too, and that's why we got along.
Well, I was just going to ask you that question about what you thought it was about you and your operation that led Frank to pick up the phone and call you. somebody like that doesn't just call people out of the blue every single day. So do you think it was simply that winning philosophy?
I mean, we got a referral. Someone referred him to referred us to him. And yep. At that time, our percentage was good, but we didn't have enough numbers. And I think he wanted somebody that was a bit smaller at that time to take his horses. And that, I mean, you need the opportunity. And that's basically what presented us, and we tried to make the most of it.
Take me back to 2 years ago when you win that first championship meet title. What was that like?
It was surreal in the moment, that knowing that we had come kind of as I said, I grew. It puts what I want to find the right word. It makes you feel like you belong. That's probably it makes you feel you belong, because I grew up watching Todd my whole life, and he's the trainer that I looked up to the most out of any trainer. Coming to Gulfstream, to the races, and obviously seeing him and Johnny V in all the races, and then here you are competing against him. I remember, like, you rewind like 6-7 years when I used to be in a race with Todd. I used to just feel like to be in the race with him, I used to feel thankful. And then here we are competing against him and competition to him. It's a moment that makes you feel like you've established yourself then. And to get it done the first time was great. I mean, and then to repeat it kind of feels like it wasn't no fluke.
What's the relationship like between you and Todd? Will you spend time talking on the backside in the morning or anything like that?
No, well, we're based different places. He's based at Palm Beach Downs, and I'm based at Palmetto in the Gulfstream. So there's mutual respect. I say hello to him, or I respect him. Obviously, he's the greatest trainer, in my opinion. His record speaks for itself, of what he's accomplished on every surface. I mean, there's no chink in his armor. He's a turf trainer, dirt trainer, long, going short. And he's definitely probably could be considered as the greatest trainer to train a racehorse as far as what he's accomplished. So there's a lot of respect for me to him, most definitely.
Talking with trainer Safi Joseph Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Saf, now that you're at the top of the mountain, so to speak, and you're the defending champion, you are now the hunted, not the hunter. Is it easier to get to the top or to stay at the top?
I would say once you have the opportunities, it's a lot easier trying to make it than it is when you have the horses. I mean, so you have the horses, you still need to stay relevant. That's the thing with this game. If you're not relevant, someone's going to take your position very quickly. So you got to stay relevant and continue to have success. So it's a bit of both. I mean, it was definitely harder to break through. But once you're here now, you got to stay relevant, because if you're not staying relevant, the horses are going to go to different trainers. So you can't rest on your laurels. You got to keep getting better, and that's what we want to do. That's what I want to do, and that's why I try to lead the team to know that is that every day we need to get better. If we're not trying to get better, then we're becoming complacent. And when we become complacent, someone's going to take our spot. So you have to keep learning and keep getting better. And I think horses, they basically teach you that every day, that you're always learning.
You know, the adage in racing is that this game will present you with the highest highs and the lowest lows. And, Saf, I don't know if anybody in the sport this year can relate to that saying better than you can. You win the championship meet title, which wraps up in April. And then in May, you get to Churchill Downs. You have an opportunity to compete in the Kentucky Derby with Lord Miles, who had pulled off that big upset win in New York for you. You're riding the highest of highs, and then all of a sudden, the two horses end up dying on the racetrack at Churchill that were trained by you. The Churchill says, Safi, that's it. You're banned. You can't race here anymore. Lord Miles is scratched from the Kentucky Derby. White of Barrio gets transferred because New York had banned you from running horses there, so he goes to Rick Dutrow. We know what White of Barrio did this year. Just an incredible run for you this spring, highs and lows. What was this spring like for you?
The spring, basically, as far as mentally, it destroyed me. You know what I mean? It destroyed me mentally. It broke you. It broke me down. It took me a lot of thoughts, went through my head. The way, like, one thing in life I've always done, and you could is I've tried to do the right things and portray myself in the right way that I would want my kids to learn from, and from people to look at him and say, hey, he does things the right way and carries himself even inside the industry and outside the industry in the right conduct. To be portrayed as some horrible human being and be accused, it was hurtful. It was hurtful in ways that I can't even describe, in ways that I would never wish on any human being. It was handled poorly on Churchill's part. They were wrong. In the end, all you could do is sit and let the truth speak for itself, which it did. And I mean, it's something that I hope the industry will learn. Every part of the industry will learn that you got to be objective and not subjective with things that happen. I mean, it was something that's very abnormal. And for them to try to pinpoint it to me without even having any reason to do so, it was hurtful. And I think, as I said before, it was basically, it was some way to get the attention off of what was going on and blame it on somebody. And I was the person that took the brunt, but we moved forward in life. And I mean, the truth prevails. As I always say, if you're telling the truth, it's going to prevail sooner or later. I mean, you can't hide the truth forever. But if you're telling lies, you have to worry. And I know we weren't telling lies. And where we're at now, I learned a lot. My faith during that time, I was always a believer, but I know that I wouldn't have got through this if there wasn't a God watching over me. Because the way things were handled, I came to find out it wasn't good. And I know he protected me and he exposed everything, and I'm in a better spot with what I learned about life now than I ever was, and I'm more grateful for the things that matter, which is family, than I ever was. And I'm not gonna use excuses. I'm gonna use it to take us to newer and higher heights.
Yeah, you know, your two horses were just part of the story, but because of the fact that your two horses were lumped into a larger pool of horses that had suffered injuries and deaths throughout the week at Churchill Downs, you kind of became the poster child. And after a Kentucky Horse Racing Commission investigation, the results came out that there were no conclusive causes for the deaths of those two horses. And I know that you were gutted, because we were texting back and forth at the time that the news came out. And I was actually hosting our weekly call-in program, which I don't often do anymore. It's usually Bobby Newman, but I was sitting in for Bobby that night, and I remember the news coming out, and I had mentioned on that program how shocked I was going to be if any of that turned out to be true. And you know, just to have yourself now exonerated is wonderful, but do you still feel like people look at you as being a quote-unquote cheater in this game because of what you had to go through?
I mean, definitely, like, you type in my name online, and that's the first thing that shows up, suspended. Why was I suspended? Basically, I should have never been suspended. So that's something you can't undo. So it's something that it hurts you. But anybody that knows me or been around me knows that's the farthest thing from the truth. You know what I mean? In today's racing industry, that's what hurts racing the most, is the hypocrisy. And it starts from the top. And there's a lot of that at the top in all parts of the racing industry right now. And until we face the truth and accept the truth and don't try to cover for certain people and then try to label certain people, the industry will never get to where it needs to get. And that's, I've experienced it, not only this, like with our success for the last 4 to 5 years, things have been done to me that I've sat silent on for years that the industry knows they've done wrong, badly wrong to me. And there's people that know that it's done, and they've sat silent about it because they know it's wrong. And there comes a time, as I said, this is, I believe it's all a bigger part of what the journey he's put me on to show it. And I'm here to change the industry for the better. And what was done to me, it was wrong, but my goal is to make sure it never happens to another person in the industry wrongfully again. If someone does wrong, hey, throw the book at them. But you can't just take people and try to label them and critique them. As I said, my horse has suffered something that's unknown, that's never happened. You got to judge someone on their record. That's never happened in the history that I run a horse. And that's something you can't foresee. And we don't know what caused it. Hey, it could... from the things I've experienced, it could definitely be an outside source that deliberately did it. Where else would he do it on a big stage like that? The first two horses that I run, it's kind of insane to even put in perspective. But as I said, Mike, in life things happen for a reason. We don't know the time for the reason. During the time, like, my faith led me through it. I'm in a position where I learned about life. I learned a lot about people. I learned about everything that matters, and we're going to continue to have success and hopefully go to higher heights and hopefully change things for the better for the future generations to come.
Can the industry move forward in a direction that it needs to move forward in? And what I mean by that, Safi, is it seems like in so many situations now with horsemen that when something comes up, a positive test or whatever the case might be, that trainer is automatically labeled as a cheater and a drug user and all those types of things, whether it was a positive, a false positive or what the case might be. Is there such a thing as due process in thoroughbred racing anymore?
So the hardest part is just in life. What sells better for the media? Bad stories, correct? Bad stories, unfortunately, sell and get more attention than good stories. And just as you said, you mentioned when people have overages or medication violations, everything's portrayed wrongfully. And that's the biggest part that we as an industry don't do. We classify any medication violation as cheating. That's totally wrong. And the media jumps on it to use it to sell stories and to get clicks and hits. And we as an industry need to do better. You know what I mean? We need to explain to somebody about a butte overage or legal medication therapeutic overages aren't classified as cheating, as you're using some kind of anabolic or blood doping kind of substance. That's a big difference. And it just seems that they're all classified to the outside public that don't understand as the same thing. And we don't do enough as an industry to explain that. And until we do that, as I said, it will continue to have the same wrong scrutiny on it. That's something that needs to improve and needs to get better, but it seems that it doesn't. You know?
You know, you take the brunt of the heat as the trainer, but it's not just you that's affected. I really felt for owner Peter Vegso and his operation. He, of course, the owner of Lord Miles and unable to compete in the Kentucky Derby. Owners worked their whole life to get to that level, and they put the money into this game to make this sport possible. And I really felt for Peter Vegso in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, his whole life he's been in racing. He spent a lot of money. He'd been training for the last 2 years or 3 years, and he never got to the Derby before. And here he is with a horse that qualifies for the Derby, and then obviously this unfortunate thing happens and the way it was handled. So it's definitely there's no guarantee for him to get back to the Derby. It's definitely a moment that was hurtful for him also, and a situation that could have been handled differently. As I said, I was the one proactive initially scratching the horses from Keeneland, just in case there was anything that was done as far as some virus going through the barn or that, because you don't know what's going on, so you're trying to be proactive in making sure that everything's taken out of abundance of caution. And for them to go ahead and handle it the way it was basically, as I said, there's a lot of ways to look at it, but it wasn't done in the correct way, Mike, and we moved forward from it. I mean, we moved forward it. I mean, people want to hear the story, obviously. That the story is going to get attention to that, but we've moved forward. But the one thing I want to do is move forward to make a change. I don't want to move forward to see that it's done to somebody else down the line. And racing, all I see is the same repeated mistakes from the top again. They say something and they don't mean it. And we need to start saying things and mean it from the top of the industry. And it starts from the top. If you can't get it right at the top, you're not going to get it right at the bottom or the middle.
Saf, I mentioned your Florida Derby winner, White Abario. He was part of this fallout for you. You were still training him. The owners decided they wanted to run in the Cigar Mile in New York. You were unable to train in New York at that point because Naira followed Churchill's lead and banned you from running horses there. White Abario finishes third for Rick Dutrow in the Cigar Mile, but as we know, he would go on to what might be a Horse of the Year campaign, winning the Breeders' Cup Classic. How difficult, or was it difficult, for you to watch him continue to develop and go on and reach those levels without you by his side?
To be honest with you, I think as God's doing in the process, it just shows the injustice even more. I mean, it was black and white. And when he won the Whitney, I turned to my wife and I said, just believe in the process. You know what I mean? Like, believe in it as in, like, this is all part of the process. Like, people are saying, oh, sorry. No, I don't want any sorries. You know what I mean? I just thought, like, it was just ironic how everything unfolded, and it was, like, just in black and white, and it made the situation even more clear for me. And then he goes on and wins the Classic. So it's just a process that you can't get it wrong. You know what I mean? You can't get it wrong, that the damage that was done to me. And White Abaria went ahead and put that exclamation mark on it, and he's proud. It's like, I was telling someone, it's like the other day, it's your son. If you have a son or a kid and you know they're taken away from you, your rights wrongfully, and are you going to wish that son of yours to go on and be a failure? No, most definitely not. You want him to succeed. And it's like a bittersweet moment. And I believe that was all part of the process. I mean, as I said, we sent him over to, we actually scratched him from Aqueduct. He was supposed to run Belmont. And we took him to Churchill to run in a grade one. We scratched him out of a grade two because we thought he was doing that good at that time. And he was scratched at Churchill also. So he was scratched there. We had to bring him back here. We trained him for the Met Mile. And then we sent him to Dutch Hill 17 days before the Met Mile. He got a tough trip there. And he ran third. He ran a good race. And I believe that was all part of the process. And as I said, time went on. When we sent him to the Met Mile 17 days before, at that time, we were still waiting on results from our situation in Kentucky. And what it came to be found is our results were there, and they didn't tell us that. And that's the most hurtful thing, is that they kept our results without telling us. They had our results out, I think, like 19 or 20 days, and they gave us no information and never revealed them for 2 months. So it was kind of acts that were deliberately handled because they knew they were wrong, and those are things that I hope never happen again to somebody. I mean, this is the first time I ever made that public, but it's things that people need to know. I mean, they need to be more transparent on that. As I said, you need to get better. You make mistakes in life, that's no problem, but you need to get better and learning from your mistakes, and people need to be held accountable.
Yeah, yeah. Who was it that withheld the results? Kentucky, I mean, Racing Commission?
Whoever was dealing with the situation. I mean, yeah. I don't know who said that, the results, but the results were, during the whole 2 months that it took the case, we were told nothing. And only after the case was basically, again, we had to do something to finally get everything to the point where we were null. And we found out that our results were basically there within 20 days. I mean, or results of the horses that showed nothing there, they had them within 19 to 20 days. And White Abaria would have never left our barn, basically, if the results were revealed at a time that there were. So
yeah. I think earlier I said the Cigar Mile was the Met Mile, was the race, his first race with Rick Dutrow, and then, as we know, he went on to win the Whitney and the Breeders' Cup Classic. And jockey Arad Ortiz Jr. in the post-race press conference after the Classic did mention that you deserved a lot of credit for the work you did with White Abaria, getting him to that point, and I thought that was a very classy move. So Saf, there's a lot of good in this sport, a lot of wonderful people in this sport, and I know that you have endured a year like not many trainers ever have, and you don't wish it on your worst enemy, so to speak. But man, all the best moving forward. I got to get to a break here in just a second, but all the best moving forward, all the best with this championship meet. Let's go get the three-peat, my friend.
Thank you very much, Mike. Take care. All the best to you.
All right, there he is, Trainer Saffy Joseph Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. He is indeed going for three in a row in the championship meet as that opens on Friday at Gulfstream Park. And, boy, a lot of layers to that conversation. We could have spent two more hours talking with Saffy, but we do have to get to a break, because when I come back, you're going to hear from trainer Whit Beckman, who is going to look back on his huge win, his first graded stakes win of his career. He did that in the Kentucky Jockey Club Stakes with Honor Marie. We'll do that next as Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Don't miss Phasic Tipton's upcoming Mid-Atlantic December Mixed and Horses of Racing Age Sale, offering weanlings, broodmares, racing and broodmare prospects, and a large supplement of horses of racing age. It is a proven venue to restock your breeding operation or racing stable before the end of the year. The Phasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mixed and Horses of Racing Age Sale, Tuesday, December 5th in Timonia, Maryland. Where will you be?
There are plenty of thrills at Gulfstream Park with live thoroughbred action Friday through Sunday and simulcasting 7 days a week. Join us on track for weekend stakes races and make plans for opening day of the championship meet on Friday, December 1st. Dine trackside in 10 ponds with an elevated view of the track and grab a cool cocktail in the Carousel Club. For reservations, tickets, and more, head to GulfstreamPark.com.
Well, Phasic's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Phasic Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're gonna have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Phasic Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Riskit is there. Real Men Violin is now in traffic. Needs to find a way through. Anna Marie comes alive with a wide sweeping move. It's wide open, top of the stretch. Stretch Stride trying to hang tough. Here's Anna Marie with a sweeping move on the far outside. And Real Men Violin punches through toward the rail. One furlong to go. Anna Marie's up for a short lead. Stretch Stride fights on. Real Men Violin down toward the rail. They're coming to the finish. And Anna Marie from off the pace to score by two. Real Men Violin was second. Stretch Stride was third. Riskit was fourth. And Awesome Road checks in fifth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always on the program. If you missed any portion of the first half of the conversation, first half of the visit here on the show with Safi Joseph Jr., all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can listen to the podcast of that entire conversation. And Safi being very candid in walking through his year, the ups, the downs. He's experienced all of them this year, and he was very candid in talking about all of that and his situation surrounding Derby Week. So head back over to the website and check it out, horseracingradio.net, and you can do that also on every podcast platform. The call you just heard happened this Saturday at Churchill Downs, and it was a massive moment for trainer Whit Beckman, his first career graded stakes win, the Grade 2 Kentucky Jockey Club going to Anna Marie, and what a moment it was for him. And Whit is now with me here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Whit, happy to have you aboard, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Congrats on that huge win.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a, nice to get the graded stake win, you know, within the first 2 years. But it's, it's been a lot of challenges, ups and downs. But, yeah, it was a peak moment.
I mentioned that you had joined me on this program for a full hour, that, and folks can go back and listen to the podcast if they'd like. You joined me for a full hour back in October of 2021. You hadn't even saddled a winner in the U.S. yet at that point, and now here you are in very short order coming back as a graded stakes winning trainer. I think that's so cool.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's like I said, the horses are the ones that take us there, and it's been, a real pleasure to train for some of the people that I do and, you know, trust in me and give me some of these better horses.
Go back to Saturday afternoon. Put me there with you. What was it like?
It was a beautiful day at the races. First of all, weather, compared to his last start that he ran, in a super sloppy track back in October. But, Yeah, we were always pretty confident that we had a horse that was going to relish the two turns. He was going to like to add a distance. You kind of saw his first couple starts. He kind of takes a minute to get himself geared up. And in those sprints, it was always impressive how much ground he closed. So, you know, having those two turns and a lot more ground to work with, Rafa just did a great job to kind of get him geared up and, you know, power home.
Is he now – do you feel like he's a major player going forward, looking ahead to the first Saturday in May?
I mean, yeah, I've seen, you know, it's always tough to say in November, you know, what's going to happen over the next 5 months. But, you know, day by day, if we can kind of continue to build off, you know, what we saw on Saturday, he's always, you know, since we've gotten him, been, you know, a little behind the eight ball. He's a late foal. He's a May foal. So some maturity issues and just, you know, some things that we were, you know, not intend on, you know, getting started real soon. So I think there's, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg with this horse. I think there's a lot to build on, a lot to grow with, and I'm excited to, you know, get him into some of these three-year-old preps here next year.
Yeah, maybe a better way for me to have asked that question would have been, do you feel like Honor Marie has the attributes that a horse needs to have if they're going to compete in a race like the Kentucky Derby on the first Saturday in May?
Absolutely. And for watching that race, you know, I think the most impressive thing is just the way he settled, collected, and he's able to kind of, you know, close that much ground. Obviously, that race is a mile and a quarter, further than they've ever been, which, you know, distance for him, I don't think is going to be an issue at all. I think, you know, it's, you know, pedigree for him is something that looks like a mile and a quarter should be well within his wheelhouse. But like I said, I think with all these horses, you know, when they win that impressively at this point, you don't want that to be their peak. You know, so kind of going back, I think there is still a lot of, you know, things that are going to, you know, get better with him. And he's going to hopefully, you know, come back a three-year-old, bigger, stronger horse and faster, hope, you know, faster than he already is.
You know, I know that you wanted to win a Greatest Stakes, obviously. Every trainer does. But to do it in that short a time, I mean, let's face it, you haven't been doing this here in the States all that long, right? And you do it in your hometown of Louisville. How cool is that?
Yeah, I couldn't have asked for a better scenario to kind of get that first Graded Stake win at Churchill. You know, my first job on the racetrack was at Churchill 20-something years ago. And it's been, you know, a long road with a lot of ups and downs, especially working with some of the guys I worked with. But, it's been a fun 2 years and just watching everything grow. And, yeah, it's a tremendous feeling, and I'm hoping to do it again for Saturday in May.
What's been the biggest key to getting to this level in such a short period of time?
The horses, obviously you need the horses to take you there, but I think just consistency, you know, just having the program, following it, not getting too down, you know, when things aren't going right. I mean, early on there was a lot of, you know, you just go back and kind of wonder, you know, if you're, you know, doing the right thing or if things are just going to take a little bit longer to kind of fall into place. Obviously staffing and, you know, just you know, like I said, attracting the better horses, I think, is the big thing.
How have you been able to do that?
I think just like day by day, I've had some, you know, horses run well, kind of get my name, get my, you know, face out there just little by little. And, you know, with this particular horse, Legion Bloodstock, who, you know, they've been a big supporter of mine since day one. And they've kind of put, you know, I guess a lot of the better two-year-olds I've had in the barn. So, you know, just trying to do well for, you know, each owner I have, and then hopefully, you know, some others see it and kind of, you know, send some other decent horses my way.
I remember that was a topic you and I discussed when you joined me a couple of years ago, and we talked about the challenges of starting your own business, and you mentioned acquiring the horses, which was, you know, first and foremost your first order
right.
of business going forward. And then I remember you told the story of your groom just quitting at that point, so you were doing everything on your own. Have you been able to kind of level the playing field there and get some help in the barn?
Yes, I am not, like, I remember that day now. Yeah, I was, you know, the end of a long day, grooming seven horses. I was hot, sweaty, and, you know, dirty as can be. And today, yeah, I've got a, you know, a great staff. I just shipped down to New Orleans, actually. We just got the crew in this morning. So, you know, we've been getting the barn together and stuff, but I've got a really just solid group of guys and women that are, you know, have been with me now for, I guess, say a couple months, which is on this, you know, in this business, you know, that's a pretty good stint. So, yeah, I think we're in a 180-degree different position than when we last spoke.
Is Honor Marie in New Orleans with you?
He is, yeah. We shipped him down. They left Louisville yesterday, and we just got down here this morning.
will the plan be to send him through New Orleans to get to the Kentucky Derby, or might you look to ship him out of there and go someplace else?
I mean, I thought with, you know, just kind of the setup of this place, he just always felt like a horse, you know, with the longer stretches that would like, you know, in not only just running, but training down here. So I'm not 100% sure what's going to, you know, happen as we get closer. But I think, you know, when you have your horse and you just kind of make sure that they're, you know, peaking at the right time and they're in the right, you know, condition, you know, physically, mentally and everything, and then kind of seeing what your timing of your races are and kind of trying to put all that together, you know, as we get further in. I mean, I don't have any intent on doing anything for, you know, I'll give him a couple months and then just kind of see where he's at and what's coming up on the prep list, and, you know, just trying to make a plan, you know, not necessarily now and stick to it, but just let the, you know, the current circumstances, whatever they are, just kind of guide our, you know, move forward.
For people that don't realize exactly what goes into making those decisions, and what I mean by that is mapping out a path to get to, whether it's the Kentucky Derby or a Breeders' Cup or any specific goal that you have in mind for a horse, how much give and take is there between you and the owners? Do they yield to you a little bit more, or do you say, hey, guys, whatever you want to do, just tell me and we'll go that direction?
Well, I think, you know, obviously this is my first time being in this position with this caliber horse on my own. And Alan and Carrie Ribble, I mean, they're just such gracious. They're such good people. I don't see that, you know, they would have any disagreement with, you know, as we start mapping out plans. I think, you know, they're perfectly fine with whatever the road, wherever it leads, however we get there, you know, as long as we get there. But they've trusted me, and so far we've, you know, got what we wanted out of him, you know, from his two-year-old year for sure.
You almost knocked off another juvenile stakes at Churchill Downs on Saturday, too. You finished second in the Ed Brown Stakes. Is it Agu? Am I pronouncing the horse's name correctly?
Agu.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good horse.
Yeah, he's a good horse, too. Like I said, I got both of these guys came in, you know, to me. And for being a small stable, we don't have, like, a ton of two-year-olds. You know, you're always hoping to have a little bit of talent in the barn. And we're fortunate enough to have two, like, you know, legitimate colts that are both, you know, proving to be, you know, top two-year-olds. You know, so like I said, we're all looking for that one horse, and it's nice to get two, and, you know, especially when you don't have the numbers where you can kind of, you know, hope out of however many you get one or two. So we're just, you know, super, super grateful and, you know, just glad we're in this position.
Yeah, much like Honor Marie, Agu was making his third career start. So tell me his story and when you kind of got a sense that he could be pretty good.
He has always been a tremendously good horse in the morning. He's always worked very well. Early on, he just had some baby stuff, which is why we kind of didn't gear him up, you know, till early, I can't remember when we ran him first, early fall, September, I believe. But like I said, he's always been in the morning as good as a horse could be for me. So I was fairly confident in that first start that he was going to run well. Obviously ran into a couple little issues, but, you know, came back and, you know, won emphatically at Keeneland and just kind of, you know, validated what we were seeing and what he's been doing. You know, he's got more than just the physical. He's got the mental aspect, too. He just has that air of a, you know, of a good horse. And I thought the other day he ran a great race. You know, I think there was a couple little greenness issues with him still. You know, he kind of flopped leads late and then flipped back. And I think just being inside, that's the first time he's been inside of horses in his races. So, you know, I think with him, too, kind of going into his three-year-old year, I'm, you know, leaning towards we'll probably keep him around one turn. He just, to me, is, you know, very sprinter type. But, yeah, I think there's, you know, a lot of potential here.
Talking with trainer Whit Beckman here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Whit, this is so cool because, as I mentioned, a couple of years ago we're talking, you hadn't yet won a race in the United States, and now we're walking through all of these top juveniles that you have and the Grade 2 Kentucky Jockey Club victory. But on Thanksgiving Day in the Falls City, you run second there with Music Street, so you kind of kicked off a huge closing week at Churchill Downs with that performance. Tell me about Music Street and that effort.
Yeah, so she's always been a filly. Like, matter of fact, she was one of the ones in the barn when me and you talked a couple of years ago. She was one of my first horses. Kim Valerio, you know, gave me her to train. And, you know, she actually, you know, probably just left the other day to go, it's going to be sold. But still, she was like, you know, one of the ones that had been around since day one, you know, one of the originals. And she's always been a talented filly. She just had some, you know, just, I don't know, focus issues and stuff. I always felt like ability-wise that she belonged,
you know, at, you know, at least at that level, even though kind of her race pattern had been a little bit inconsistent, she's a filly we knew wanted to go long. The mile at 16th was even just a little short. Her wins came at a mile and an eighth, mile and a quarter. And then just kind of coming into this year, we had just, it was tough getting races to go. We had to run her on the grass at one point just to get the start. And I think just not being able to establish like a real rhythm, we didn't really get to see her best. And then just kind of towards the end of the fall, you know, she did draw into an off the turf spot that I thought, you know, she would win, but she ran a good second there. And, you know, we were looking at this possibly being the last start of her career. And she popped out of that race with just this intensity. And I just said, you know what, I think this filly, I know she belongs. Let's go ahead and put her in. And she, you know, she rewarded our effort, you know, just in putting her in the spot.
How many horses do you have in your barn now?
18.
Good number, or you want more?
I'm always looking to get a few more.
Especially the right ones.
We had, you know, 25 through the summer, but now just kind of consolidating for the winter. We sent some, a couple to the farm. Sabalenka, she just went to the farm. Like I said, Music Street's going to go sell in January. And then, yeah, like I said, we're always, you know, open to taking some more horses. You know, like I said, we've got the system to handle much more. But for right now, it's a good number, especially when you got good ones. It's, you know, it's all relative.
You know, Whit, you come from a horse background with your parents being involved in the industry, and you got a chance to work with some of the top trainers in the sport, like Todd Pletcher and Owen Hardy, Chad Brown, for example. Talk to me about some of the things that you've picked up on and learned along the way that are now helping you as you continue to grow your own business.
I think, yeah, I mean, just coming down, you know, the example of my dad, I think consistency is number one. You know, you get up and you show up every day, and every day is, you know, more or less all you can really do with horses. You know, we can do all we want to plan and try to, you know, establish, you know, campaigns and all this, but really it's just showing up daily, being focused on the details. There's little things that can make a lot of difference. Like I said, just having a routine, having a consistent, you know, kind of style upon which everybody can kind of fall into with help, with horses, with everything. And for me, it's about keeping a nice, relaxed, easygoing atmosphere. It's, you know, I think a lot of, you know, just being, you know, just kind of like level, steady, you know, because you go up, down too much. It's, you know, this is definitely a route race, not a sprint. So just getting things, you know, trying to run themselves almost and letting everything else kind of fall into place.
Has there been anything that's surprised you over the past 2 years or so since you went out on your own and started training here in the States? Or was there anything that really struck you as being unexpected that, as you were getting started?
I don't know about unexpected. I think you know, being in the business as long as I had, you know, prior, you kind of have an idea of what you can face. And obviously Saudi gave me a lot of, like, when I was over there, I saw a lot of things I never thought I would, you know, have to worry about. So, you know, I think just staff has been one of the tougher things, you know, just like trying to get somebody, you know, people on board to share your vision and to be as enthusiastic about what, you know, the business is you. And that's, you know, one of the things that we're definitely made a ton of headway with. But that was one of the tougher parts of, you know, the first year and a half. But aside from that, I mean, as far as like just racetracks and day to day, everything, you know, it's, you kind of know what to expect, and sometimes it's the unexpected, but you almost can't expect the unexpected because with horses, you know, anything's possible.
How do you go about finding those people that will share your vision?
I think, with all of them, you get them in, and, you know, I try to just create a culture where, you know, everybody's just nice, like, relaxed atmosphere, but we're getting the job done. And, you know, obviously I think paying them well, that helps too. But yeah, and I think a lot, it helps too when you have better horses, you know, when guys are winning, when horses are running well, when things are going well, it's a lot easier to, you know, get people on board. It's like I said, we work hard, you know, and it's day in, it's day out. So to have those moments, you know, kind of, you know, gets you through some of the monotony and the grind that, you know, this job can turn into.
You know, you were talking about your dad, David, who is a veterinarian and an equine vet, and he was talking to you about, you know, the routine, showing up every day and doing that routine and putting in the work. And as you were telling that story, I was thinking back to the time I got a chance to stop by Todd Pletcher's barn at Palm Meadows, and he was just getting ready to send out the next set, and Todd went down and took a look at all the horses, and as he was doing that, the exercise riders were coming out from the other shed row almost as if there were jockeys coming to the paddock for a race, and it was so well organized, and it was such a well-oiled machine. And I mean, I guess that's maybe what you're talking about when you show up and you have your routine and it's organized and it's structured, right?
Well, absolutely. Like, you know, this is a daily thing. So to come in with no plan, to come in and just kind of, you know, freewheel it is a little bit tougher. So like I said, working with him, working with Chad, you just see there's, you know, everything is planned. Everything is structured. Everything is routine. It just helps, you know, for people and horses to kind of just fall in and assimilate, you know, the patterns of what they need to be doing on a daily basis, you know, when it's the same thing every day. I mean, nobody likes to come in and take the temperature of the room and wonder what's going to happen. You know, we all like to know, you know, I'm going to come in and going to get this, is going to go to that, and everything's going to kind of flow, you know, smoothly and harmoniously. And, you know, we're always aware that things are going to change and there's going to be adjustments you need to make. But at the same time, if you can kind of have that foundation, that base just there and operable, it seems to make things a lot easier.
Would you say you run your operation more like Todd or more like Chad?
I don't think I think everything runs more or less the same way. I don't think I have a specific style. I think it's, you know, taking the best parts of both of them and kind of turned it into my style. But I don't necessarily think that I'm doing one thing more like him or, you know, Todd or Chad. I think it's kind of a nice harmonious collection of a lot of different things and some of my own ideas. And obviously it's, you know, you're, depending on where you are, you're going to have to change things. So just, we make it work. We make it work.
You know, let's face it. Being a horse trainer is not an easy profession. I remember my dear friend Jude Feld, who was sitting in with me doing the shows for a long time. He wrote a piece that won an Eclipse Award for Keeneland, and it was titled, "If It Was Easy, Everyone Would Do It," referring to all of the challenges and the sacrifices that trainers have to make. There aren't many days off. You're there and working long hours. You're starting early in the morning. What's the key for being successful in that profession?
So I guess, you know, you got harmonious alterations of extremes, you know, highs, lows, staying in the middle. That's, for me, it's staying in the middle, not jumping, you know, it's one of those things. I'm going to take tons of credit when they win and I won't take all the blame when they lose. You know, it's just about understanding like what your process is and everything's going to happen around you. You know, there's only so much we can really control. The rest of it is up to, I mean, people say racing gods, the horses, there's so many different aspects, you know, that you try to kind of hone in and rein in and, you know, keep as, you know, tidy as possible. But for the most part, for me, it's just maintaining that kind of, you know, level, focused vision forward and not letting the, you know, the small things, you know, shake you. And yeah, like I said, big picture, just keeping everything and keeping it fun too. It's got to be a little fun. If you don't have any fun doing this job, then it's way too hard. You know, it's way too involved. You know, it's got to have a little bit of enjoyment somewhere along the line. And that's in the mornings, not just winning races, you know.
Harmonious alterations of extremes. That might be the greatest quote that any trainer has ever given here on Trainer Talk.
Okay, well, I can't take credit for that quote because that's actually a quote from a guy named Sri Nisargada Maharaj, who's an Indian, like, mystic sage. And I read that. I was like, that is just, like, because that's the rules of life, you know. We're all trying to, like, you know, figure things out in the midst of all that. So as it applies to life, it applies to this little microcosm of racing even more so.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. No, I love it. You mentioned the word fun. How do you go about keeping it fun for the people that work with you and make sure that things don't get monotonous?
Yeah, I mean, I think how your personality, just having a light heart and just, you know, laughing and letting people know that, you know, it's not, it's a big deal. What we do is important, but at the same time, you know, you got to give yourself a little bit of room. We all got to do that. Can't be too hard on yourself. Can't be too hard on any aspect of that. And so just, I don't know. I think it's just those moments, you know, just a smile, you know, good morning, just the normal stuff, you know, just
being a good person.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, try to, you know, bring in breakfast and just do the things, you know, that are just kind of show everybody how appreciative you are. And, you know, just, it's, you know, it's not easy. I can't do it alone. So I'm just, you know, super grateful to have everybody. And I just want to make sure they know that. And if that's only being a nice guy and, you know,
that's the best I can do.
Yeah. Yeah. What will you do away from racing? Are there things when you do get a little time away from the barn and the horses that you'll enjoy doing?
Well, since I started this business, I have not had as much time as I used to, but my daughter's 7, and, you know, when I'm not racing or working, you know, I try to spend as much time just doing the, you know, being a parent and, like, getting to, you know, see the world through her eyes. And, you know, the, you know, when you're a kid, everything's so much more, you know, just kind of, I don't know, free and easy. We don't have the structure and the rigid, you know, everything we're trying to do to maintain our, you know, position within, you know, society and, you know, the working world. But yeah, so just spending time with her. My family is a big part of my life. My sister, she's a, you know, huge help with my business. Lindley, she does all my books, does a lot of my accounting, you know, the ordering supplies, helping Matissa, you know, my dad will come out, and then we just all try to, you know, share and all that. So, you know, it's the family, my daughter, and there's other stuff. I like, you know, exercise, just normal stuff, play some tennis every now and again. I don't know, just whatever.
One of the sacrifices that I had mentioned earlier, and this is something I talked about with Todd years ago when he joined me, maybe even for the first time on Trainer Talk, was the sacrifices trainers make being away from their family so much. And he talked about that with his children. Yeah. And how there were things that he would miss, you know, soccer games or whatever the case might be. How do you balance that? And is that difficult on you?
Yeah, it's definitely difficult. Last year, I actually went all to Tampa, took the whole string down there. So I was away for 4 months, and just, you know, she's young, but it's like, and I, you know, I worked for Todd when his, you know, kids were pretty young, and you could see it's not easy. You know, there's just so much we've got to do. And I always thought, like, if anybody did an amazing job of it, it was him. He was always, I thought, you know, so present, and, you know, he always had his family with him. And so I think for this year, I actually, you know, I have horses down here in Fairgrounds, and I'm going to keep a string up at Turfway so I can be back and forth. So, you know, I can have my, you know, see her every week and not have to be away like I was last winter, which I think was tougher. And, you know, it's, like you said, some people want to, you know, the job, or, you know, the life has to suit the job. I'd rather the job suit my life. And part of that is going to be, you know, being present in hers and, you know, being as good a dad as possible, and not necessarily her saying, oh, he wasn't there, or wasn't, you know, as present as other, you know, parents are.
Well, when you hear you talk and you hear your philosophy and your approach to the business and to life, it's not difficult to understand why you're having so much success. All the best moving forward. Keep it rolling and have a wonderful meet at the fairgrounds this winter.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. That is trainer Whit Beckman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Again, Safi Joseph Jr. was with me for a visit in the first half of the program and really gave a candid overview of everything he has gone through this year. And then Whit talking about, you know, some of the ways that he approaches not just the business, but about the way he approaches his personal life and trying to balance all of those different things. And yeah, I love that quote, that harmonious alterations of extremes. That is exactly what this sport can present. And that's true for Safi Joseph. That's true for Whit Beckman and every trainer who chooses to take on this profession and train horses for a living. Fun show. If you missed any portion of the program, head back to the website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast whenever you get some time. You can do that too on every podcast platform, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Podbean or Spotify. However you listen to your podcast, type in Horse Racing Radio Network and follow along with this show and all the shows we bring your way each and every week here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, to our sponsor, Fasic Tipton, to Safi Joseph Jr., and to Whit Beckman for being with me on this week's edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. And thanks to all of you for tuning in each and every week. I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk.